Most microbial evolution experiments do not involve gene exchange. In fact, gene exchange typically is excluded from these experiments because it's a complication. This creates a situation where the degree of evolution that can occur in the laboratory can pale to a large degree to what you can see in the wild. Of course, in the wild, you have huge volumes, you have large amounts of time, you have great heterogeneity, but you also have this potential for seemingly good species that you would expect to not be exchanging genes between each other, to in fact be exchanging genes among microbial organisms. And as a consequence, microbes have a flexibility in their evolution that can be rather dramatic, particularly in comparison to the degree of flexibility that we're used to when thinking about, for example, the evolution of modern animals. So this chapter creates kind of a bookend to the previous chapter in completing the introduction to what microorganisms and microbial evolution is all about in talking about gene exchange. Okay, so gene exchange. A key aspect of what sexual processes are all about is that they separate alleles from one another. And to appreciate what this is all about, we can look at the situation where, in fact, alleles are not separated from one another. And that process is known as linkage. So a linkage is the physically binding together of two or more genetic loci, although the idea of linkage can go well beyond that. So this linkage can include when you have two loci that are physically close together on the same chromosome. When that occurs, it means that the separation of these loci via a recombination event, via crossing over, via molecular recombination, is simply less likely. Recombination events don't happen at every nucleotide. They happen randomly within chromosomes, more or less, but there's only a finite number of crossover events that occur in a chromosome during a sexual process, a sexual event, and where they fall is going to be dependent upon random processes, but the likelihood that they're going to fall between two loci declines the smaller the target size of that region between the loci. So if loci are well separated, then there's a reasonably high likelihood that there can be recombination events between those loci. When loci are tight together, the likelihood of a recombination event occurring between these two loci is much smaller. So two different loci that are close together within a chromosome are unlikely to be separated by recombination per a given sexual event, whereas two loci that are distant from another, there's a greater likelihood that they'll be separated. So linkage tends to occur between loci that are close together. If you do not have recombination going on at all, or specifically molecular recombination going on at all, that is, no crossing over, then it doesn't matter where on a chromosome two loci are located. If there is no recombination, there will be no recombination event between those two loci, and therefore those two loci are essentially physically linked together, even if they're quite distant from one another on the same chromosome. And the same is true even if loci are found on different chromosomes. If there's no independent assortment, if there's no reassortment, if basically there's no sex going on, then even if two loci are found on different chromosomes but are found in the same cell, they're not going to be separated from one another by sex, by genetic recombination events. And then, therefore, for all intents and purposes, those two loci are in fact linked together. Even if they are not technically, chemically, physically linked together, they're still not becoming separated from one another by sexual processes, because there is no sex. And it can go beyond that. So if you've got two loci that are found in separate organisms, if those two organisms, if their reproduction nonetheless is linked together, such that the survival and reproduction of organism A and survival of reproduction of organism B are tied together, then they're, especially if the two organisms are actually physically associated with one another, then in a sense their loci are linked together. that if something in this locus and a locus in this organism causes the whole consortia of organisms to be less fit, less able to reproduce themselves, then the whole group of organisms is no longer going to be as effective. So in a sense, you have this linking together physically when two organisms are associated with one another, such as we are with our normal flora bacteria. And this linkage together, this passage through time of these two organisms together, in a sense also links their genetic loci together. And particularly if one of the organisms is dependent upon the other for its reproduction, you can believe that there is going to be selection within these linked together loci for what essentially is niceness, for a cooperative behavior between these loci. And in fact, there is a general tendency when you have linkage for there to be coevolution between whatever it is that's linked together, whatever it is which have their fates linked together, and this coevolution often leads to cooperative behavior among these linked entities. So we can apply the idea of linkage more broadly even than this. So a favorite example of mine is that your car keys and your car are not linked together. And what that means is that you can end up at your car or in your car if it's unlocked, and not be able to drive your car because in fact you don't have your car keys. And the reason you don't have your car keys is because your car keys and your car are not linked together. If you had a little chain on your dashboard and attached to the dashboard at one end and attached to your car keys at the other end, and you couldn't separate the two, then no matter what, when you sat down at your in the driver's seat of your car, you would have your car keys because the two would be linked together. But the fact that the car keys are not linked to your car means it's possible to have your car keys but not have your car, but more likely to have your car and not have your car keys, and therefore you can't operate your car. Now, there's an advantage to this too, and that is that if you had your car keys and car linked together, then they'd be, in a sense, linked together perhaps for everybody. And the whole purpose of having car keys is that the car keys are not linked to your car, and therefore not just anybody can drive your car. So the idea of linkage, this physical linkage, it actually has a relevance that go beyond simply the linkage between two different loci that happen to be closely found together in the same chromosome, although that's important as well. Linkage, as we alluded to above, is important for the evolution of cooperation. When you have two entities that are tied together, that are difficult to separate, their fates, their reproduction are associated with one another, and they are physically associated with one another. When you have these kinds of things going on, there tends to be a tendency towards evolution of cooperation. Particularly if, again, organism A does something that organism is not very nice towards organism B, then you can have the result that organism B is unable to thrive. But if organism A requires organism B in order to thrive, then organism A is going to hurt as well. And so a linkage between the loci, even if they're found in different organisms, can lead to tendencies for these loci to be cooperative, to evolve towards being cooperative rather than to being not cooperative. And in fact, you see the same thing when you've got two different loci within the same organism. If those loci are linked, there will be a tendency for a coevolution between these loci, such that the loci increase their levels of cooperation with one another. Basically, the presence of one locus increases the functionality of another locus and vice versa. And in fact, you might end up with loci that are so linked together and cooperative with one another that one locus actually can't even function without the presence of the other locus. It's kind of like a commensal organism without its host. It doesn't have any ability to function without any host. And therefore, unless it has an ability to move from host to host to host, discarding hosts as it uses uses them up, there will be a selection for a niceness towards whatever host they have. And that selection for an increased amount of cooperation, for an increased amount of niceness between organisms, for a lower degree of virulence of one organism towards another, of antagonism of one organism towards another, these are all things that come about as a consequence of physical linkage between two individuals, as well as a linkage of the fates of these individuals. And these are something that we'll be talking about a great deal over the course of the rest of the semester. And in one area, what we'll be talking about it is in terms of the evolution of multicellularity. So when you have a multicellular organism, the cells within those organisms are linked together. They're linked together physically. That's what a multicellular organism is, a bunch of cells that are linked together physically. And they are also linked together in terms of their fates, in terms of their reproductive fates. If you have one cell that is in some way not being cooperative within a multicellular organism, that's going to reduce the overall fitness of that organism. For example, a cancer cell at an extreme is a cell that's found in a multicellular organism that is not being cooperative with the rest of the cells in that organism. And you have nonetheless this linkage together, and this has this tendency to bring down the potential for the multicellular organism to reproduce, and as a consequence, it also eliminates the potential for the cancer cell to reproduce. So, in fact, the fact that cells are linked together and the fact that their evolutionary fates are linked together, that their reproductive ability is all linked together, tends to result in a selection for cooperation within these multicellular organisms. And this is essentially the essence of what multicellularity is all about, at least from an ultimate perspective, contrasting an approximate perspective. It's a bunch of linked together cells that are cooperating towards their mutual reproductive success. And thus, the linkage of these cells is very important for the evolutionary stability of multicellularity. So sex and linkage can be seen as opposite ends of a spectrum, whereas linkage is the tying together of alleles, sex is the separation of alleles. And similarly, one can differentiate linkage disequilibrium from linkage equilibrium. Linkage disequilibrium is basically when you have an excess of linkage within a population, that is, alleles that ought to be separating from one another, in fact, are not. You expect them to, but they're not. And linkage equilibrium represents the situation where, in fact, the alleles are as separated from one another as is possible, as statistically possible. Linkage equilibrium is this case where you have lots of sex going on. It's the situation where basically the recombination between alleles is happening as much as you would expect it to happen based upon the mechanics of the whole recombination process. Whereas linkage disequilibrium represents a relative lack of these recombination processes, such that there is an overabundance of association between specific alleles more than you would expect to be the case just based on randomness. So linkage disequilibrium, it can be a consequence of non-random mating. If individuals that have basically fixed within their own genomes an association between two specific alleles tend to mate with one another rather than mating with others, then the association between those alleles will persist. Essentially, if you've got individuals that are true breeding at two different loci, and the loci are closely associated, well, actually, even if the loci are not closely associated, the two alleles fixed at these two different loci in true breeding individuals, they're going to remain associated so long as the true breeding individuals are breeding with one another. That way, even if you have sex going on, sex can't separate the alleles because there's no other allele to swap in the place of the two alleles that are associated with one another. If sex rarely occurs within a population, then the potential for there being recombination events between two alleles is going to be relatively unlikely simply because there's not a whole lot of recombination events going on. And so there will be a persistence within the population of these alleles, association between alleles. Spatial structure can give rise to non-random mating. What that basically means is that, in this instance, is that the individuals that are mating with one another are mating with one another preferentially with those individuals that are close by them, are nearby them. And if this happens, then you'll have a tendency for the individuals that are mating together to be more similar genetically to one another than they are to other individuals that are some distance away. This is what happens when you have subspecies. With subspecies, you have a preferred mating reproduction within the subspecies versus with members of other subspecies of the same species. And therefore, you have an increased genetic similarity between the individuals that are actually doing the mating together versus between two individuals randomly chosen from the larger species. And so this too, for the same reason that non-random mating can lead to this linkage disequilibrium where there's an association between alleles that's greater than you would expect based upon statistics alone. Basically, as shown here, there's an overabundance of association between the big A allele and the big B allele. And there's also an overabundance of the association between the little A allele and the little B allele. In fact, there's no big A, little B, and there's no little A, big B. They're just absent. That's an example of linkage disequilibrium. Where are the big A, little B individuals and the little a, big B individuals? Well, good question. They're not there. And it could simply be because these individuals are preferentially mating with each other, and these individuals are preferentially mating with each other, and there isn't mating going on between them. That's non-random mating, and one way that can occur is if the big A, big B individual are found over here in one island, say, and the little a, little b individuals are found over here on another island. They're not crossing between the islands to mate. They're only mating among oneself. That would be an example of spatial structure giving rise to non-random mating. And in fact, that's what's going on in this fourth bullet, is that when you have well-isolated subpopulations, that isolation, that's a aspect of spatial structure within the population, a lack of random mixing across the population, which can give rise to non-random mating. So linkage disequilibrium, when you see it, either imagine that the individuals involved are not having sex all that often, or instead, when they're having sex non-randomly, such that you have a retention of association within alleles, basically in isolated subpopulations. Whereas if we're having random mating across the whole population or the whole species with lots of sex going on, you would expect the separation of these alleles. And that situation where you have a separation of alleles, that's what you're seeing down here with linkage equilibrium. Linkage equilibrium implies random mating. It occurs if there's frequent sex going on. Imagine there's no sex going on at all. Then you'd have a clonal population and you wouldn't have separation of the alleles at all. So the other extreme from a lack of sex, of course, is to have a relatively large amount of sex. So frequent sex is something that gives rise to a linkage equilibrium. Well-mixed populations, that's essentially the opposite of a population having spatial structure. And then subpopulations that are infrequent communication, basically meaning that the subpopulations are not well isolated. So again, this is another way of saying that you have a well-mixed environment, which is also gives rise to a random mating. And if you have random mating in combination with frequent sex, then you have an expectation that the big A, little b alleles are going to be no more likely associated than the big A, did I say that wrong? That the big A, big B alleles are going to be no more likely to be associated with each other than the big A, little b alleles, or the little a, big B alleles, or the little a, little b alleles. In fact, with linkage equilibrium, you should have a situation where all of these types are equally prevalent within the population. When you start having a larger frequency of one of these recombinant types within the population, that's an indication of linkage disequilibrium, which again is seen when either you have non-random mating going on or you have rare sex. In some ways, rare sex and non-random mating are two sides of the same coin. If you have two genetically identical individuals mating with each other, particularly if they're true breeding at all loci, then the effect of that would be the equivalent, in terms of increasing the genetic variation in the population, would be the equivalent of these individuals not having sex at all. And so a clonal population where there's no sex going on is almost like having two individuals that are homozygous at all loci having sex. The net effect is the same. You do not have separation of alleles from one another. So instead, you have this linkage disequilibrium. So once again, linkage equilibrium, think sex. Linkage disequilibrium, think lack of sex or relative lack of sex. So linkage disequilibrium. So linkage disequilibrium refers to an absence of separation of linked alleles and implies an absence of sex or a reduced amount of sex. And this is something that you see explicitly in asexual or clonal populations. So when you have a clonal population, when you don't have sex, you have linkage disequilibrium. In fact, you have linkage disequilibrium in the extreme. There is no way to separate two alleles that are found in association with one another, except via mutation. An absence of linkage disequilibrium in turn suggests an occurrence of sexual reproduction. So a linkage disequilibrium, think lots of sex. Linkage disequilibrium, think not lots of sex. In purely asexual populations, alleles from genes in different parts of the genome should give identical evolutionary patterns among individuals in the population and should be in significant linkage disequilibria. So when you don't have sexual processes going on, when you don't have horizontal gene transfer going on, basically every gene in an individual is evolving essentially in parallel. They are found within a single lineage. When that lineage splits, both of the sets of genes in each of the resulting lineages go on to evolve independently, but they're all evolving together. And as a consequence, when you go to make evolutionary trees, when you pull together phylogenies, when you have a purely asexual population, when you don't have horizontal gene transfer, the phylogeny associated with individual genes within these groups should give the same phylogeny no matter which gene you choose, and therefore the gene phylogenies will be equivalent to the organismal phylogenies. And this is something when you don't have sex, when you don't have horizontal gene transfer, particularly horizontal gene transfer if you're talking about evolutionary relationships above the level of the species. What you have essentially is linkage disequilibrium, and it results in what can be described as the uncomplicated situation. And evolutionarily, in terms of organism relatedness, evolutionarily, the uncomplicated linkage disequilibrium situation is where gene phylogenies give you the same organismal relationships as the organismal phylogenies. You go to any gene and they'll look like, they'll give you the same evolutionary patterns. And so the opposite of that, in contrast, sex and sexual reproduction would break up these associations and generate linkage equilibrium. Therefore, linkage equilibrium, or genealogy incongruence among genes in natural microbial populations, are consistent with genetic recombination and sexual reproduction in populations. Okay, not necessarily sexual reproduction if we're talking about bacteria, for example, but when you have sexual processes going on that result in some kind of genetic recombination, what it tends to do is make gene phylogenies based on individual genes, different from what you see for the organism as a whole, the organism phylogeny, or the gene phylogeny is associated with two different genes, you won't see the same evolutionary patterns. And this is because the genes themselves, in fact, have not been subject to the same evolution. Instead, if you've got a gene that evolved over here, and another gene that evolved over here, and then the two genes come together into the same organism, of course those genes are not going to have the same evolutionary pattern, because one of them evolved in one place and the other evolved in another place. And bring them together and they're going to be different evolutionary patterns. So linkage disequilibrium, this is the situation that you see when there is a relative lack of sex. It is what you see, it is what allows the coevolution of genes within genomes. It is what allows the coevolution of organisms that are otherwise physically associated with one another. It gives rise to relatively uncomplicated evolutionary patterns because the patterns associated with all of the entities involved tend to be similar, if not identical, to one another. Sex is the more complicated situation. It results in linkage equilibrium, and this gives rise, especially in the case of horizontal gene transfer, to phylogenies, evolutionary relationships or associations of genes, patterns associated with genes that differ between genes and differ between the organismal phylogeny. In fact, the whole concept of organismal phylogeny to a degree can be thrown out the window based upon horizontal gene transfer, because what is the organismal phylogeny if it's not the equivalent to the gene phylogenies? And what might the organismal phylogeny be if the phylogeny associated with the individual genes differs from gene to gene to gene? So once again, linkage disequilibrium, no sex, it's the easy situation. Things start getting complicated when you bring in horizontal gene transfer. So what we have here is a bacteriophage. It's, in fact, my favorite bacteriophage, bacteriophage RB69. I keep meaning to get a license plate that says RB69 for my motorcycle. But I just know that the state of Ohio is not going to let me do that. In fact, they wouldn't even let me get a license plate with the word phage, P-H-A-G-E, on it. But instead, a friend of mine now has that plate, so all is good. So this is RB69. RB69 is a T4-like phage. I did my PhD studying bacteriophage T4. In fact, my dissertation title was The Ecology of Bacteriophage T4. And these are all the genes found in the 170 or so KB kilobase genome of RB69 or phage T4. There it is, 167,561 nucleotides. And within this genome are co-adapted gene complexes. This is seen particularly in the morphology genes, where you have, for example, the head of these phages. Those genes tend to be linked together. They're close together in the genome. The base plate, which is part of the tail of these phages, these genes are closely associated within the genome. The tail fiber genes are right here. What all of these genes have in association is more than just the fact that they're close to one another. It's that they interact together, or specifically their protein products interact together in the virus particle itself, in the virion itself. So what you have are proteins that are associated with one another. And in order to build up these very complex virus particles, these proteins have to be able to stick together rather effectively. When you've got two proteins sticking together, it means that the areas where they're in contact have to be complementary. They have to be complementary physically, and they have to be complementary chemically, so that negative charges or opposite positive charges or hydrophobic interactions can occur, etc. Now, in order for this complementarity to exist, the proteins have had to have an opportunity to co-evolve. And in order to co-evolve, the genes, the underlying genes, have to have remained associated with one another over relatively long evolutionary time spans, so that changes in this gene can be can come to increase the interaction with the gene that codes for this protein, and that can lead to changes in this protein that cause it to interact better, and basically have this love fest going on between these proteins where they become more and more closely integrated together, and as a consequence they can function better. If the proteins are all floppy and they don't stick together well, then the virion particle is going to fall apart, and that's not a good thing. But having these proteins really sticking together, being very complementary in terms of their physical shape and their chemistry, results in a greater functionality. And the only way you're going to have those genes staying together, staying close together over long time periods, evolutionary time, is if the genes are linked together. Now, it turns out that these bacteriophages are incredibly sexual. They're perhaps the most sexual organisms on Earth. When you have two of them ending up in the same cell, they recombine together like crazy, because part of their reproduction, even in the absence of co-infection, involves a lot of recombination. And this is recombination with themselves. It's kind of like when you have two genetically identical individuals. They mate. If they're pure breeding at all of their loci, then it's almost as though they didn't have sex at all, at least with regard to genetic variation, because in fact there is no opportunity for the separation of alleles, for the swapping out of one allele for another, because all of their alleles are identical. So it's almost like they're having sex with themselves. And this is essentially what these bacteriophages do. They get into these cells, they go through their replication process. Their replication process involves a huge amount of recombination, but it's all with themselves, so there's no increase in genetic variation. There's no separation of alleles from one another. Even though that there's actually recombination going on between loci, there's recombination of essentially the same allele in. They're swapping the same allele in, so that there's no separation of alleles. But when you have two of these phages together in the same cell co-infecting, then you can have swapping of alleles if the two phages have different alleles. And as a consequence, you can have separation of loci. So to keep the loci together, and so that they're not switched out, if in fact these are co-evolving loci, to keep the alleles together, they're close together physically. They're linked together in the classic sense. They're right next to each other on the chromosome. Another way of saying this is that if you've got these co-evolved gene complexes, these groups of genes, they don't really function that well without each other. They can do just fine inside the same genome, but one way these genes propagate is by moving to other genomes, and as a consequence becoming the head genes, or the base plate genes, or the tail fiber genes in another phage's genome. And that way they've increased their representation within the phage community. And in order for the head genes to find their way into another genome, in other words, in order for horizontal gene transfer to occur that takes the head genes from this genome and puts them into this genome, the only way that's going to happen is if all of those head genes are close together. The only way it's going to happen is if you have a potential for a recombination event taking all of those genes simultaneously and moving them from one place to another place. And that's not going to happen unless the genes are closely linked together, unless they're physically close together. And so you've got these incredibly sexual organisms, but nevertheless, you see within them these groups of genes that tend to move between phages consistently together. And they do this because if you separate out these genes, you're going to end up with proteins that have not co-evolved closely together, separated, put together because the co-evolved ones have been separated, and you're going to get much less functionality. So in order for these genes to be highly successful, they've got to retain their ability to interact, or their products to interact closely together. And the only way they're going to do that, especially where they're being swapped from phage to phage to phage, is if they're closely associated with one another physically on the chromosome. That is, they're linked together in the classical sense of linkage. So note the grouping together of genes for molecularly interacting proteins. In this case, the proteins making up the head of the virus. And this grouping together is linkage. So these guys, they're all linked together. They're closely associated on the chromosome, basically almost as closely associated as they can possibly be. These loci are able to co-evolve because they're linked together, and therefore they tend to be passed both in terms of vertical inheritance and in terms of horizontal gene transfer as a group, and that allows them to remain together, closely associated over long time periods. And the result is that the interacting gene products, the proteins, are able to evolve these closer and closer associations with one another, and therefore greater functionality. So these groups tend to be able to move from one phage genome to another as an individual group. If you had a gene here and a gene here and a gene here, when you had a recombination event that created a new phage type, which seems to happen quite often, you wouldn't end up in this new phage type necessarily with all of these co-evolved genes together. And as a consequence, there would be less functionality and therefore a lower potential for the survival of the recombinant product. But when you have all of the alleles that, all of the loci that are associated with a given function that that produce a bunch of proteins that interact closely with one another, together on the chromosome, when you have a recombination event, there's a higher likelihood that they are going to end up in the new phage recombinant product altogether. And as a consequence of this, there's a greater potential for functionality in of these genes within the recombinant product, therefore a greater potential for survival of the recombinant product, and therefore a greater potential for survival of this grouping of genes, of these linked genes, of these co-evolved genes over evolutionary time. So the RB69 story has nothing to do with transduction. I mean, we're talking about bacteriophages, but when we talk about linkage, in the case of RB69, we're talking about linkage within the phage genome. Now, there is also a consequence of phage action is transduction, but in this case, it's not the phages that are necessarily evolving, but they are effecting horizontal gene transfer between bacteria. So transduction also has something to do with linkage. Because it's a sexual process. Basically, every time you have a sexual process, you are either disrupting linkage or, in the cases that we're talking about here, you actually have successful gene transfers that occurs precisely because of the preservation of linkage. I guess that's kind of complicated. Linkage works both ways. At any rate, temperate phages, for example, can carry genes that modify the phenotype of their hosts during lysogeny. And these genes, particularly if they're not explicitly what we would think of as phage genes, we can think of instead as being transduced genes. These genes are often called converting genes. Conversion has to do with the phrase lysogenic conversion. So when you have a bacterium that's not a lysogen, if it acquires a prophage, as they're called, the prophage can carry genes that that when they're expressed can modify the phenotype of the bacterium that's carrying this prophage. And this modification of phenotype is called lysogenic conversion. And to make things even more complicated, the converting genes themselves potentially are morons. These are genes that may be acquired by illegitimate recombination, for example, from a bacterial genome. To the extent that the prophage is not induced, that is that the prophage remains within the genome of the bacterium. So the prophage essentially serves as a multi-gene complex within the genome of the bacterium that it's inhabiting. So to the extent the prophage is not induced, to the extent it remains essentially as a bacterial gene, then its genes are linked with those of its host. So in this case, it's not a lack of sex that's linking these together, but instead it's more equivalent to having two organisms that have their reproductive fate linked together. In this case, the phage and the bacterium. When a phage is a prophage, in order for that phage to replicate, assuming it doesn't turn into an induced phage that basically replicates as a phage. For the prophage to replicate as this gene complex within a bacterium, then the bacterium itself has to replicate. So the replication of the prophage and the replication of the bacterium are linked together. And this provides the incentive for the prophage to be cooperative with the bacterium. Anything the prophage can do to increase the fitness of the bacterium it's inhabiting, can increase the fitness of the prophage itself. Now, there's limits to this because ultimately the prophage could very well display a productive cycle, and it's possible for the prophage to lead a bacterium down a phenotypic path that ultimately may be good for prophage induction and not so good for the bacterium. But those are details that I like to think about, but for the moment we probably should ignore. So this prophage, it expresses genes. So these genes that prophage express include various kinds of virulence factors. There's this whole slew of bacterial virulence factors that in fact are not encoded by bacteria, but instead are encoded by these prophages that exist within the bacteria. And among these prophage encoded genes are the Schickitoxin genes, which are the genes that make E. coli 157H7, the quote-unquote bad E. coli. Cholera is a consequence, the disease cholera is a consequence of cholera toxin, and cholera toxin produced by Vibrio cholerae is in fact encoded by a prophage that's infecting the V. cholerae. And then diphtheria toxin is the classic example, because of the first one discovered, of a pathogen, Corynebacterium diphtheriae, which has a prophage that carries a virulence factor gene, and in this case, it's the diphtheria toxin that is prophage encoded. So these nasty pathogens are nasty predominantly because, in fact, they carry these prophages, which in turn carry various toxins. And this is an example of lysogenic conversion. It's the modification of the phenotype of these bacteria as a consequence of these bacteria carrying these specific prophages. Prophages and bacterial genes are not completely linked, since prophages and bacteria can always go their separate ways. That is, via the induction of the productive infection by the prophage. So you've got the prophage and the bacterium, they're doing their thing, they're all together, everybody is happy, the prophage is contributing to the fitness of the bacterium. But ultimately, the prophage can go its separate evolutionary way and ecological way as well. And as a consequence, this potential to separate from the bacteria means that the genes associated with the prophage are not completely linked with the genes associated with the bacterium. So there's the potential for the genes associated with the prophage to be selfish relative to the bacterium. And that's explicit when we're talking about phage genes. All the genes that contribute to the prophage being induced and lysing the bacterium or otherwise reducing the bacterium's fitness. I mean, those are clearly genes that are not cooperative genes so far as the bacterium and prophage are concerned. And this is because the prophage makes a living in part by escaping from its bacterial host. And when it does so, it doesn't care about the bacterial host. So all those phage genes that contribute to that escape, these are selfish genes. These are defection rather than, they encode defection rather than encoding cooperation. But there's this middle ground here where you've got these genes that are expressed by the prophage that seemingly, at least to a degree, maybe perhaps, are helpful to the bacterium. And so long as the prophage and the bacterium maintain this stable coexistence as essentially a single genetic entity, then the prophage is better off if the genes it's encoding are, in fact, at that time helpful to the bacterium. But as I said, you always have this complication that the prophage may very well be pushing the bacterium down some kind of path that ultimately isn't good for the bacterium but might be good for the prophage. I belabor this point because I've got a paper I published in 2005 where I sort of make that point. But I still, even though I'm the one who made it, it's, I think, a pretty valid point. When you have this potential for the link genes to become unlinked, you always have to suspect that there's this possibility that, in fact, the link genes are not completely as cooperative with one another as they might otherwise be. So prophages are also subject to recombination with other phages. We looked at recombination between phages, or talked about it, with regard to RB69, although RB69 is not a temperate phage, so it doesn't form prophages. And it's also possible for prophages to recombine with various kinds of small pieces of DNA, including the DNA associated with the bacterial host, for example, generating these morons, the illegitimate recombination of more DNA into a phage genome. Prophages can both lose and gain genes. Bacteria can both lose and gain genes. When they're gaining genes, some of these genes may be genes that can contribute to lysogenic conversion. And again, this is the acquisition, the gaining of genes is often the acquisition of morons. This prophage gaining of genes is another aspect of sex. It's an aspect of sex that, again, involves phages. And it gives rise to this mosaic nature of phage genomes.